Hello, I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
And welcome to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
This is a poem about one of those places you end up at and could probably never find again. Well, I couldn't anyway. I've got no sense of direction. It's for Will Burns, who probably could. Mayfly. On the way back to the city after the long weekend, we stop off by prior agreement at the Mayfly, arrange ourselves like collapsing parachutists. Last of the nectar days, hind end of the country, the afternoon readying itself to make excuses and leave us to our unslept dishevelment. Some nameless river goes by. The sun makes brilliant hoops from tarnished glasses. Half-picked bones. Soporific blue bottles. To have to leave this for the road's demands. The mercy of one last round. Not enough to delay us, where people live their whole lives, most likely. Watch this cherry tree convulse into winter. What? 70 times, maybe.
That was Mayfly by Declan Ryan from his debut collection, Crisis Actor.
Who have we got today in the studio, Rachel?
We have the wonderful Victoria Adukwe-Bulli, who is a poet, writer and artist, an alumna of the Barbican Young Poets, a recipient of an Eric Gregory Award, who has held residencies in the US, Brazil and the V&A Museum in London. She's currently a doctoral student at Royal Holloway, University of London, supported by a Techni Award for practice-based research and creative writing. And her debut collection, Quiet, is published by Faber in the UK and Knopf in the US.
And joining Victoria today, we have Raymond Antrobus, Jamaican British-born poet, writer and performance poet. Ray is the author of Shapes and Disfigurements, Burning Eye, 2012, To Sweet and Bitter, Outspoken Press, 2017, The Perseverance Tin House, 2021, and All the Names Given, Picador and Tin House in the US. He's the winner of the Ted Hughes Prize, the Rathbone Folio Prize and the Somerset Maugham Award, as well as being a finalist for the Griffin Poetry Prize and a shortlistee for the Ford Prize and T.S. Eliot Prize. Raymond is also the author of the children's book, Can Bears Ski, which is fantastic. And he's the winner of numerous poetry slams, too many to mention here. We are absolutely delighted to have Raymond here and Victoria. Hello, guys. Hello.
Hey.
Victoria, would you like to kick us off with some poems?
Yes, of course. Okay. I'm going to start by reading a short one. And let's read. Okay. I'm going to read Dreaming is a Form of Knowledge Production. Nobody's immune to their ego taking the wheel. Dreaming is a form of knowledge production, and they don't want it to be that easy for us. As in, lay your head on a pillow. Wake up holding something new. I said what I said, not what you say. I said, pigs are outside the house, but next door this time. It's not something our relationship will be able to survive. He doesn't show it, the cat, but he loves me so. He has the gene, but it hasn't kicked in yet. Another 1,000 years, all thinking and no feeling. Shut up about Freud. And I will now read another one. Epigenetic. Maybe it's nuts, but it helps sometimes to think that here in the ridges of these fingernails, someone in this blood thinks it's shit what we've settled for, is shocked to a stupor by what they see, the trouble we've seen, the more of it coming. Someone with this mouth, these dark lips, is watching the screen of my vision and screaming at it. I believe in this and what it poses, makes possible, dear astigmatism, dear taste buds, dear someone not far away but here, not gone or geologic, but now and really here, denser boned and better sunned than I, raised on maize, not wheat, some she, some they, some he or other, in these 100,000 hairs, these 10 pints of blood, is pained by the cruel audacity of this, hysterical in no good way. I do believe, dear earlobes, dear little toes, dear lines on my palms, dear sideburns, dear serotonin, we don't have long, dear plasma, dear earwax, it must be true. Someone written in you still knows what it felt like, our life otherwise than this. If your pain is alive in me, so too must be your joy.
Mm.
Thank you so much. You read, I think, probably my favourite poem from the book, Dreaming as a Form of Knowledge Production, mm-hmm. with my favourite line, which is, shut up about Freud. And I feel like I have my own interpretations of that line, but there's a part of me that just wants to launch right in and be like, okay, talk to me about that line and that poem and what it means to the book.
Let's start with that line. I guess I really do feel that I've had dreams that maybe I was in a funk, I was really sad, or in a heavy place, and then it's happened that I've had a dream and I would wake up and I would feel great. And I wouldn't even remember the dream. I wouldn't wake up thinking, oh yeah, I did this, then I did that. I'd probably be on the bus or like in Sainsbury's, wherever. And then I would have something trigger a memory that I had a dream. And then I would realize that's why I'm happy now. And it's that to me is just such a powerful thing. Like, it's crazy to me that there can be a film that played in my head and it changed the level of like oxytocin that was in me that day. Mm-hmm. And I guess also to say knowledge production, I don't necessarily have to be meaning like, oh, like book knowledge, but I just mean some kind of knowledge of the body that the body carries that changes it, or which I also think is politically relevant, that type of knowledge too. So I guess the poem is made up of so many lines. I wrote that poem in a workshop with Holly. Wait, my brain. Sorry, baby brain. I wrote this poem in a workshop with Comic Timing by Holly Pester. Holly Pester. Luke, Ed Luca.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, it was with poetry school. And I wrote this poem in that workshop and I used different things that had happened in the week or different things that I'd said in that week. So the line, it's not something our relationship will be able to survive, is something I've actually said to someone. And in the poem is also a dream where I had a dream that police were on, like, knocking on the door next door. So things in that poem were just like a mixture of actual real things that had happened that I just mashed together. Mm. But the shut up about Freud line, I guess I just, you know, people ask me about that line and I'm like, you know, I'm not knocking Freud. I just feel like that's not the only place, mm-hmm. or that's not the only way mm-hmm. I care to talk about dreams. Mm-hmm. And also I feel like there's a very sort of like Western fascination with Freud and it's so hypersexual and just like, I'm like, cool, nice, but there's more.
I love that.
Yeah.
Like, thinking about embodied knowledges and just like ways that have their own way of being interpreted mm-hmm. or thought about, that doesn't have to be pinned to some like dominant way of theorizing or intellectualizing something.
Yeah.
Which makes me think about the book as a whole, you know, mm-hmm. this like incredible sort of like, you know, you're talking about a very like moving from the biological outwards into sort of more nebulous, dreamy states, domestic states. Mm-hmm. And quiet the book is sort of set up almost like a kind of like a really surreal painting of like a floor plan or something. That's how I think about it. It's in these sections: a door, a key. You move to a room of conditions and refusals, a seal, a key, interiors, a seal, a door, night garden of yes and dreaming. And you're kind of negotiated through this incredible palette of thinking and feeling within a domestic space that feels kind of reclaimed in quite an intellectual way, actually. And I'm just so into the structure and would love to hear you talk about that structure as well, because it feels so unique.
Oh, thank you. The structure, I think, was for me as much as, you know, the reader, because I, at the time of this book getting picked up by Faber, it wasn't a complete thing yet. So I had the challenge of really wanting to deliver something that wasn't finished yet. And I had to therefore make myself a kind of, as you said, floor plan or roadmap to just get myself to the way I wanted to feel by the end of the book. So I really just had to design that architecture as a way of helping myself know the spaces that I wanted to write into. And it was very helpful. I didn't know that it was going to work, but I actually do feel that, you know, there's a chronology to the book. A lot of the newer poems, bar a few, are sort of towards the end. But having that floor plan was helpful because it also meant that in thinking of it as a book, I always thought of it as a book. And that's not me saying that I couldn't just put a collection of miscellaneous poems together. I wanted to have a book. And it meant that with that structure, I could then go to the front and be like, what's missing here? Like, what's between this poem and that poem? What needs to happen? And then write into that space. And then I guess thinking of like the titles and stuff, I wanted to have space to sort of write about the personal, to sort of like reminisce on like girlhood and stuff. But I also wanted to have these sort of like doorways and like sealages, or as if that's a word, like, you know, ways of putting things behind and saying we're going forward now. And so have these sort of like interlude kind of functioning poems. So yeah, it was very much for me. It worked, I would say, for me. And I wanted to leave my working in there. And that's why there's like so many sections, because I could have taken them out. I could have not included them.
It really sort of like, because they're really immersive poems, but then that kind of artifice almost is put up in a way that feels very like you're also recognizing that you're in a poem at the same time, as well as like feeling all the poem-y things.
I'm interested in this idea of like quietness. Because obviously a book is a kind of speaking, a kind of interruption of quiet. But at the same time, I think that a poem can also be a kind of space that, through talking, demarcates a kind of absence or a quiet in the centre. It makes the space, it lays the space before the quiet. And of course, at the end of a poem, we return the reader to like that quiet space. I'm interested in why there's lots of really good titles in the book. Why you say, you know, when we think about how we come up with our titles, maybe we steal one from a poem or we have a line or something. Why that word, you know, a big abstract noun? I suppose maybe it's a concrete noun. Is it quiet? I guess it's a thing.
It's abstract. Abstract noun.
Yeah.
It would be, yeah.
Because you can't pick it up. But I guess you can encounter it with your senses?
Yes, I guess so.
It definitely is an abstract noun. Yeah.
You're getting philosophical there.
The OED definition of quiet now, please, Victoria.
Why that?
Of all the other words in the book that you could have foregrounded?
Why quiet? Because it's a quiet word, but... This is a book in which I wanted to kind of take some risks with what would be expected of me. And I think that if you walk into a bookshop and you see a book called Quiet, it's not asking a lot of you, really. It could even be telling you to be quiet.
That's it. I wondered if there's an imperative in there, like shush.
Yeah, and it's and that's not my meaning, but I think it's a word that it asks you to. It kind of, it's quiet. Like it has an effect in the sense of, are you telling me to be quiet? Are you telling me to shut up? Like it's sort of, it's ambiguous in a way. And because the other option, for example, was to, and I never even mentioned this to the publisher or like to Matthew Hollis, the editor, like it never even came up like that. But the other option was to call the book something like Black Noise, which is a poem in the book. Mm. And as a term, as a sonic term, Black Noise still actually means something very much like quiet. But I just thought, look, I want people to lean in to listen to the book. And quiet and all its different meanings is what this book is very much about. Mm. And I want to be brave enough to put that small, tiny little wallflower word on the front cover and see if people see if the expectations of others are mirrored back to them once they actually open the book and read it. Mm. So I think I wanted to be a little bit subversive by just saying, like, I'm going to just go quiet. You know, it's going to be a quiet title. And then you open it up and then, you know, like straight out the gate, like If Sickness Begins in the Gut, If I Live in the Belly, it's not quiet opening.
No.
So I guess I want to just kind of be a little bit sneaky like that.
Yeah. No, I thought that's what I thought. Yeah. And I remember when you were writing the book, talking to you about the cover and stuff like that as well. There's just quite a, that seems to be like a little, If you get it, you get it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And there's a miniature shy thing going on in your book as well. Mm-hmm. Like this zooming from like the very, very tiny particulars and aspects of a thing outwards into like how they're seen, like how things are seen from a overview or like a bird's eye view or something. And quiet, that I'd never thought of it as a like imperative or an instruction before. Mm. And that's such an opposite way to think about it. I almost saw quiet as the kind of like ring around the book. It was like the quiet space that's created for the sound within.
Exactly.
But even as an imperative, it's quite it can be like quiet. Like a school teacher, but it can also be like quiet.
Yeah.
You know, it can be listen. like hush.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't necessarily, it's not like an imposition often. Gosh, I wish somebody could just tell me, like, Jack, quiet.
Yeah.
I need somebody.
I need to be told
Rachel
that.
Allen,
no, we got to tell each other.
so, yeah, I think it's, in terms of like something to be evoked or as an instruction or as a thing, I think it's a real puzzle, that word. It's, and I really like the different tensions that it throws up and how those are kind of teased out, like you say, in the individual poems.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, like I think for me, when I even just saw the title, there were two things that were happening that I thought were at play. One being quiet, being a kind of a door into an internal space, right? So I like this idea of titles being doors, right? So I see that. And then there's this other kind of subversive thing, which is around over my years, like in the quote literary scene in the UK, I can't tell you how many times I've been told to be quiet in the Poetry Cafe, the LRB, like quite, just because like I'll be there and I might see someone I know. You know, I can get quite animated. Even when I saw Rachel once in a coffee shop, we were like, and people were like gravitating.
And each other.
You know, we just, you know. So there's, again, a bit like what Jack was saying, there's also a kind of, a mirroring of that. Like, okay, interesting. Why do you, this is a public space.
Yes.
Why are you asking? Yeah. You know, I'm just having a conversation.
It's like a reclamation of the word, I guess, in that way.
I think so. And I think, you know, your point, Ray, is so important because, like, I, like, having spent a little bit of time in the countryside, like, I don't like it when it's too quiet. And I'm not saying I want, like, ambulance sounds and, like, sirens and all sorts of stuff. Like, I'm not talking about that. But, you know, like, just sort of for example, like when I visit like Ghana, like where my grandparents were, like sitting outside is such a thing because of the weather. And you can always hear children playing. You can always hear people like having a laugh or a joke. You can hear people selling stuff. You can hear people having a fight. And it's like everything feels like a commons. Mm. It all feels shared. And so here in like, you know, in this culture in the UK, like it's like, it does feel like you're being told to be quiet all the time. Many different ways as a woman, as a black person, as a child, all sorts of ways you're being told to be quiet all the time. So I think, Rachel, your point is a good one, because my relationship to the word is not singular, but there is a kind of reclamation happening in that here are the ways that this word, here are the things it brings up for me in the wake of all of those different impositional usages of it. Mm. And here is where, here are the spaces of quiet that are comfortable and on my terms, but also here are the ways that it can be a kind of violence or a kind of, you know, interruption or a kind of suppression as well.
Yeah, and that's how it's like, for me, it's like a, as Rachel said, it is a quite an intellectual feast, but at the same time, it's also a very intimate book. Mm. Like, you know, you've got poems in there for your friends.
Yeah.
And you're kind of almost, you know, showing who, I don't know, who you are as a poet, but also who you are as a, I don't know, a comrade, a listener, mm-hmm. and a speaker. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's such a rich book for that.
Thank you.
Ray, I wonder if we could hear some poems.
So I'm going to read a poem from All the Names Given, and I'm reading this poem in a way because I think there's certain elements of it that it shares with some of the philosophy of Victoria's book, Quiet. This is a kind of monologue poem, but it's a kind of internal monologue at the same time. It's, you know, the internal noisy kind of poem. And I wrote this during the pandemic when I was having some real kind of spirals. And I checked in with my therapist, and I've done years of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's about tracking the way, the language you use to talk to yourself and about yourself. I mean, understanding that those are choices. So this is one of those poems where I kind of wrote right after the therapy session just to kind of see what the choices I was making in the language for myself during the pandemic. It's called I Ran Away From Home to See How Long It Would Take My Mother to Notice. Are you my drunk teacher who took our game of rounders way too seriously? Are you the boy who said I had the ugliest smile on the playground? Are you the girl who toe-punted my balls and made me a piss sack of blood? The girlfriend who slept with women behind my back said it wasn't cheating? I don't know what I'm saying. Would you be my friend? I spent hours in the house alone as a child. I left fingerprints on my sister's CDs so the music kept skipping. I wanted her friends to be my friends, but I wasn't invited to her parties. Are you the party? Are you my dad lying on the sofa saying I'll soon be dead? When I pull What is Existentialism off my mother's shelf, Simone de Beauvoir says, the movement of my transcendence appears futile. I don't know what that means, so I put it back. Fuck, who loves me? I'm testing everyone. I need space for all my old and new gooey needs and projections. I need constant blaring validation alarms. Give me award ceremonies. Please observe my wall of fame. Best second-guessing overachiever. Best internal monologue while drying dishes. Best self-promoter at the charity fundraiser. Best awkward silence in a moving vehicle. Best bad advice to a couple in crisis. Best non-smoker in the smoking area. Most self-centered fear during the global pandemic. Lifetime Achievement Award for most convincing head nod in a crowded pub. Most triggered person in an empty house. And then I'll read one shorter one. This poem is called Language Signs, and it speaks to my grandfather, who was a preacher, and I have you know, boxes of his sermons, which I look to and read sometimes. And I've never really managed to kind of get any of the language of his sermons into a poem, but some of it, or a kind of, I don't know, an osmosis of it appears in this poem, Language Science. How shall it be known what is spoken, for yea shall speak in the air? 1 Corinthians 14:8-9. J.K. Antrobus, grandfather, I dreamt you returning your reading glasses to your eyes, opening your Bible, pointing at the words you couldn't say. You pointed at mercy and failure, and then you pointed at your white hair and your lips, and then at the ceiling of your church as if it were the roof of your own mouth. And I understood as much as the stone plaques on the walls, or the pews which were wood, a word that once meant tree. All the men that raised me are dead, those bastards. I'm one self-pitying prick of a son. How do I bring back men who couldn't speak, men lost in books, drinks, graves? Where do I turn, knowing they left the hot taps running? I want to say, sorry, come to me. Cut the hedges on your face so I can read your lips.
Thank you so much.
Ray, I feel like with all the names given, there's a kind of kind of deeper like level of introspection than in your earlier work. Mm. And it's a kind of rooting out. It's like the sort of getting into like the proteins, the different kind of the different kind of nutrients, and some of that's like in childhood, and some of that's in kind of like familial history, and it feels kind of like, I'm interested. Like you sort of say, talked about like lockdown and that crisis, and it's interesting how that's kind of also brought out kind of quite a lot more kind of humor and irony in the work. Mm. And maybe that's kind of when you do, you know, that a level of introspection also kind of like, as much as it kind of throws up horror and shame, also kind of like you can't, there's a certain embarrassment about oneself. And I don't know, I just feel that's a kind of a slightly newer tone in there a little bit. Is that something that you sense in...
Yeah, you know, funnily enough, Horror and Shame was a working title.
Really?
Almost. I think The Perseverance in particular was a book which I was conscious that it was a kind of spoken, voice-led kind of book. And I think with this book, you know, and also I had like different people, you know, Don was my editor for All the Names Given, and he kind of, I think, steered towards a more slender poem, and at times a more, maybe, I don't know, philosophical, or, you know, just other ideas were invited into the poem, I think. Mm. But at the same time, my ambition was different with this poem. I think I did want it to be a more, how can I say?
Interior? Like feels like there's an interiority.
Yeah, like it is a, for the most part, a very interior book. And then in a similar, can't really say, I'll just say from my perspective, but one of the things I think that All the Names Given has in common with Quiet, with Victoria's book, is that I think there's that interior happening, the voice, interior voice, but then there's also this kind of consciousness of how one sees the body and the kind of ways that has been read or assumed, and then there's a kind of a resistance to that. So it's, you know, it's, I think All the Names Given I wrote with a real kind of need to subvert really some of those projections, reflections, ideas. To be honest, it was a really it was a painful book to write. I had a lot of breakdowns when I was writing it for numerous reasons. Like the pandemic was like a tough thing to get through. Mm. I was entering marriage and had all these ideas of like, I don't know what the hell? Like, my parents were never married. Like, how is this happening? I'm just going to work. I was on the way to becoming kind of, you know, living in America as well. Yeah. Mm. And that whole kind of, you know, there's a part of me that's a little bit Americanized now. And then that kind of also can show up in the work. I don't know. It was.
But there's a reckoning. It feels like a kind of self-reckoning.
Yeah.
And maybe that, like, maybe the perseverance was kind of like you were writing poems for, like, with a sense of, like, what a poem does, and in that kind of writing a kind of, I suppose, a first kind of book of poems, it felt like.
Yeah.
Whereas this felt more like kind of, like, the poems were being written because you write poems.
Right,
you know?
Right.
They were arriving through some sort of other process. And I think that's a different kind of lyric attitude. And I think that it means that you have to be more grabby and complex.
Yeah.
And like those little, like, the little award ceremony for yourself in that way. Just hilarious. Like, but even just like finding that device, which is kind of both silly and ironic, but it also gives you the opportunity to hop around.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I feel like that is like when one is more introspective, the complexity of who we are outside of the usual categories and classes falls away, and we have to have a bit of that, and we have to have that part of ourselves as well.
Mm.
And so I feel like there's a kind of breadth to some of the poems.
And you're checking yourself in a really funny way as well. Mm. Like that, I can't remember the line, it's like most self-centered in the global pandemic or something, or like most concerned. Yeah. And there's a sort of like sending up of, I guess, that interiority as well, which adds to the tensions, I suppose, that the poems are being written out of. And that Simone de Beauvoir pulling Simone de Beauvoir off the shelf. We were just talking about learning through reading. I used to sit outside Morrison's when I worked at Morrison's and like read it, feeling really like grown up and pretentious in my hometown. And it's just, you have a way of like zooming people right into the action of a poem in this book and a story, and then flinging them somewhere else and like upsetting expectations again, as Victoria was talking about. And it's amazing to hear about actually the context that the book was written in. Was the majority of it written in the pandemic, or was it?
At least half of it was, because like Victoria, like I had almost like a different book. I mean, before the pandemic, and then the pandemic happened and it just changed the work, because the book opens with me going to Antrobus, this place in Cheshire called Antrobus Village, which is, you know, my namesake village. So in a way, like I think having a literal physical place with your name is such a gift to any kind of artist, because, you know, we have all of these kind of ideas of homeland and returning to this great mythic place. Mm-hmm. And I literally have that, and it's in England. And even in that kind of place, even, you know, like, I can't walk through the UK borders customs without that question. Like, where does this come from? Your name, what is that? I mean, as soon as I say, well, it's an English name, it's like, no, it's not. And then I have to defend it. So I'm like, it is, you can look it up, it's in Cheshire. It is, here you go, mate. You know, and so like,
as if the border guard's going to know where Cheshire is. No shade to Cheshire, but like.
But that very kind of tone, I think, informs the journey or the mode of the book. Because I think one thing that all the way through all the names given does is that it doesn't quite know where it is or where it's treading.
Yeah.
So there's this, and I was aware that in the perseverance there was almost like a certainty in it. It's like, this is who I am. It was like a very much a kind of, I was affirming something in that book.
Yeah.
And this book is like, oh, actually, I don't really know. sorry, everyone. Don't know.
I feel like that is so generous though, because I also think that the perseverance is sort of a very sort of making a statement type of book, like really like drawing some lines around things and saying like, this is how this works and this is how it is. And the second book is, you know, All the Names Given. It's kind of like, you didn't need to share that with us.
Mm.
It feels really generous because it feels like that's the first book, I feel, as a person who knows you, as like on a personal level, like the first book is Raymond Antrobus, but the second book is like the book you wrote for Ray. Do you know what I mean? And I just feel that there's such a richness that you chose to make that a book because the process that's happening feels really different.
Yeah, no, that's sure. Yeah, I appreciate that.
We were talking about sort of humour and irony a little bit, just in the way that that like creeps in. I mean, I think the common mistake is that the poetry of emotion is this earnest, like flat, direct, but like actually like that's vulnerability. We laugh when we're anxious, we laugh when we're nervous, we laugh when we recognize how silly we've been, how stupid we've been, you know, like and I feel like the way that the sort of polytonality of that comes through, and like you say, like it's not.
And it's brave to be funny, you know, like that's the hardest thing to actually be like, that was ridiculous that I thought I knew.
The
thing that I learned through, I'd say, performance is that you can't bullshit an audience because you feel it when they're not with you. And then the thing that I learned through the page is that you can't bullshit an audience because you feel it. Like, you know, I'm like, oh, wow, there's something really incredible about the idea that you can write something and someone hasn't even heard your voice and they just read it and they're like, bullshit. I don't believe you.
I don't believe you. You're lying.
You know what I mean?
Or or like that, like you're sharing this thing that's supposed to be difficult, but it's like, you're not finding this difficult to share. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like a proper bastard for saying that. But sometimes I am just like, what is that? I mean, this is like obsessed philosophers and artists, like authenticity, like that big question, whether, you know, it's the Frankfurt School or like, or in the Night Garden, you're like, whatever you're watching. like, you're just that thing that, and pop music as well. Like, why when I hear like somebody sing, am I like, feeling? And sometimes I'm just like hollow.
Yeah. I don't know what that is. I don't know. I think there's no word for it, but I just think that we do as humans have a sense of something being real or not, you know, and
when you're truly embarrassing yourself, that's when it's real. And when you see the embarrassment in other people's writing.
Like you can hear the writer checking themselves as they
write.
That's
a risk. Exactly. That's real risk, isn't it?
I feel like Noor Asadeh is probably the person to talk about this. But like, like you can, you know, in the poem you read, the one where you say, you know, you ran away from home. Like it's just... I loved hearing that because it's just so interesting, and it's not just, oh, it's so relatable. It's just interesting. Do you know what I mean? It's interesting. It's fascinating. And it's not pretending to be something other than what it is. And that makes you really want to be in a relationship with those parts of yourself that feel like that.
Yeah, like it's empathetic rather than sympathetic, right? You're like, you're not just going like, oh, I feel for you. You're like,
sorry.
Ouch, yes. I feel for you. Like, And I think that, I think it comes through complexity. I think like when somebody presents something neat, we're like, that's not emotion.
And not knowing as well. It's like, as you said, with your first book, you felt like maybe with this book, there's like a dismantling of the certainty that you felt before. And I think the introduction of ambivalence is, that's the thing I always look for when I think about like the truest or best poetry. Like I always go back to Elizabeth Bishop. She's like my queen. She's like the queen of ambivalence. She's like, was it this color? I don't know. Was it this color? Was I sad? I don't know if I was sad. Maybe I'm just sad in this poem. And that's what I feel like that poem and the book does.
Well, we were talking earlier about with Victoria's quite about like knowledge and knowing and like epistemology, like that's a much broader subject and like school of philosophical thinking than just like positivism, just like what we can prove, which is like there's like wonderful philosophies of like gossip as a form of knowledge. There's like of course there's like the somatic, what the body knows, and like and the unconscious, and like if we do know things unconsciously, but we don't know that we know them, what can we say of, you know, all these kind of like these really knotty things. And I think when we get into poems, we're like able to bring the complexity of knowing back within reach, in a way that can be shared. And I feel like...
And I guess another cousin, I suppose, in terms of a cousin of the idea or some relation with an idea, like one place where I think, where I don't think All the Names Given and The Perseverance departs was like in its sound, in its the way that it engages with sound. Like this book, All the Names Given, is kind of, you know, I've got this kind of punctuated captions throughout, and that's all about showing this kind of sense that we all think of as, sound and the captioning. Like I interviewed a bunch of people who work as captioners, and they were fascinating interviews because they all had this kind of very... actually like industry certainty about how to articulate a sound, about how to describe it. But then when I introduced this idea as, well, I'm deaf, this is my relationship with sound, it was then like, oh yeah, oh that is interesting, oh yeah, I didn't, you know. So it was like I got to introduce that as a kind of as a poetic into the book, and a kind of dismantling of what people's a certain idea of you know, what sound is. And I suppose the way that the pandemic came in is because I'm not a big TV watcher or film watcher until the pandemic, when I just watched everything. I watched everything and I was like, oh my God, TV's amazing. Oh my God.
You've heard about this thing we've got? TV. Television,
like, yeah. TV, like I watch all of Breaking Bad, all of The Office, the American version of The Office, like loads of it. But I'm watching all of it with subtitles.
Yeah.
And I was always like looking at the how they're describing a sound. I'm like, I didn't hear. And then I realized how philosophical sound was, because there was so many sounds that were being captioned, like glass falling in the background. I'm like, I didn't hear that. So for me, that's a philosophical idea.
Yes, because
it doesn't exist to me.
I hear that.
So then through the page of the book, and one good thing about Picador is that the shape of their poetry books is almost like a screen. So I almost thought of the book as a kind of screen that you open up into, and then I'm like, oh yeah, the captions and these kind of ideas are also transitions into, I don't know, like you say, it's a very kind of internal thing. But I'm trying to curate a journey. I think what Victoria was saying about like the structure. I think I am interested in making books rather than like just collections. It's like, here is some sustained, I don't know, experience, idea that I'm trying to write through. And hopefully by the end of the book, you too as a reader have gone through it and experienced that. And, you know, you don't know.
You have both brought in some knowable items today.
Oh yeah,
let's see. What have we got? The talismans. It's come to that point.
I don't really have a. You know, I had to kind of just go and look for one because I don't really. Have I lost it? Anyway, for the listeners, I don't really have a writing talisman, but I thought, okay, what could I bring in today? And I'm holding a tarot deck. And the card that I have taken out and evidently misplaced is
You pulled on air. That's so cool.
I did. The card that I took out and have misplaced is the Magician card. Here it is.
Oh, up your sleeve.
He hid himself.
Yeah. So, what number is it? Number 8? Have I remembered it?
Is that an infinity?
No, number 1. There? Yeah. It's the first card. But, I guess I chose this card because I feel like... I do think that when you write, you are kind of trying to do something magical. There's like a transmutation happening. But also I just think that when I try and put something into words, it's not that I want it to stay in words. Sometimes I'm thinking in an image, or I'm thinking in a installation, or I want to build something. I've got ideas of things I actually want to make physically. And so I guess I relate to this card because, you know, you've got a person standing before a table that has a cup, a coin, a sword and a staff on it. And you don't know which one he's going to use, but or they're going to use.
What's
but
he holding there?
Some sort of, there's a word for it. It's an old word.
Is it a wand, basically? Or is it like, or is it a...
It could also be a candle.
It looks like a...
There's a word for it.
Yeah, no, yeah. I can't think either. I
can't
it looks a little bit like a rolling pin.
Whatever site of production you want this stick to be.
Yeah. But yeah, it could... Be...
So you get the magician a lot.
I haven't pulled in so long, but it's like one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Are you into?
I have a lot of friends who are really into it, so I'm sort of like absorbing from them tarot stuff. But
yeah,
my daughter is just getting into magic tricks, and I learned to do the French drop.
Oh yeah,
French drop,
which is where you hold a coin like between, and then you instead you go to like you're picking it up. But in actual fact, you drop it into the palm of your hand. So you do this and take it away.
Oh, and then you...
But it's in that hand. And you can do just like click your fingers.
Wait a minute, the magician just revealed his secret.
Well...
That's the first move.
I didn't know how that works.
Yeah, it's nifty.
No, no.
It's... Oh, you just killed the magic.
Well, if you buy a magic set for $12.99...
The magic circle are going to come for you. Don't they do that? The magicians,
never seen
they
again.
Come for you as you release them.
It's called the French drop, guys. I mean, if like you can find it in a $12.99 magic set. I don't think... If my five-year-old can do it.
I think
Jack
this is
Underwood
such a...
Jack Underwood disappeared after the recording.
Made himself disappear. Yeah. He bought it on his own.
This is a really beautiful symbol for thinking about writing. And all the different tools that you need.
Yeah,
and the kind of support. And the magician feels like they have a very, very strong posture here.
Absolutely.
I appreciate the floral work going on here
as
well.
Foreground.
All these little flowers.
Tulips and roses.
Mm-hmm. Ray, what have you brought in?
So, something seemingly
what is this?
Different, but like, I'm bringing this in as an idea of like poems as gifts.
Uh-huh.
And I was so moved by this idea that like, when I wrote To Sweet and Bitter, which is a pamphlet of poems. I hadn't shared the book with my family, and it's like I wrote it while I was, like my dad had passed, and there was all kinds of dynamics in my family that I'd kind of isolated myself from to write through. But the day that the book was published, my sister gave me this. This is a for listeners, a silver box. And it looks like it could be like a watch box or of some sort. In gold lettering on the front, it says Too Sweet and Bitter is the name of the book. And my sister gave me
big reveal
pencils.
Ooh.
And she had shown me, because I didn't know that she'd read the book, and to show me that she had read the book, she had lines from the poems put onto the pencils. And just... like this idea of the poem as a gift, I think this is the most kind of, I don't know, literal but also significant gift I have received. For
it's like
something
a never settle. Never
yeah.
settle. You know? Like, this is what you want when you know that people have read your book. Like printed lines onto stationery that you can then, so touching.
I can't look at this without feeling... seen, encouraged, loved, you know, and it's also a kind of way to, you know, sometimes you need something to keep you going, you know, and I like to have ideas about who I'm writing for as well. And I do think, you know, I do like this. I didn't even think about it before, but I was so, enamored or moved by this idea that like my sister read my work.
Mm.
Yeah,
and I was like, of course, you've read it. I really hope, you liked it. Like, I really hope you took something.
I noticed, Ray, that some of the tips of the pencils were not sharp. And I'm not suggesting that you've been shoddy. I'm just like, do you use them?
I have used some of them.
Because that one looks, And what do you use them for?
So I'd been writing things. So, where is it? Which one is it that's not sharp? There was one that
I think To Sweet and Bitter.
Yeah, To Sweet and Bitter is the one. That's the one. There's only one that I've been using.
And what do you use it for? Like grocery lists.
You're on the phone and you're like...
So I do a thing of like my first drafts are often, as even this, as all in pencil. Mm. There's something I need, there's something that comforts me about the impermanence of it. And I don't feel any way about just kind of writing something really fast in a pencil. So right now I have like a poem in front of me of it's written in pencil. And it's just like, I don't know, it's probably all terrible, but I don't care because it's
pencil.
It's pencil.
Yeah, it's your workings out. Yeah.
It's my workings out, 100%. Right.
I'm the same.
Right, you know, and I love what Victoria said earlier about putting the workings out in the poems.
Show your workings.
Because, you know, that's how, in a way, like, that's how you trust it.
Yeah.
It's that like, oh, I see how you've arrived at this. I see how only you could have said this. Only you could have written that. Mm. And that's what I suppose people are often looking for in the art that they consume. Like, what is something that is so, I don't know, authentically, like, almost this person?
Processy.
Right. Mm. You know. Mm.
Yeah.
I know. Nice.
I mean, there's actually quite a lot. There's a lot of common experiences that one goes through. It's like the specifics, isn't it? And the one thing that I think, like, the one thing that stops a love poem just being a love poem is like the particularity of the person. And the mind working through that. I mean, it's often not the situation, which you never really find out. You know, it's not like, and then Debbie said to me this, and then, you know, you don't get like the drama. Mm. You just get the feeling. Mm. And like it's the mind at work on that subject, you know, and the particularities of that mind, not another mind, that particular one, you know.
Yeah, so a poem, a poet and a book that really kind of inspired me, I guess, in that sense. Actually, I kind of, you might appreciate this, Jack, but I was kind of obsessed with like the Spanish 19th century poets, like, Jimenez literally has the epigraph at the front of All the Names Given. And he wrote this book, very kind of high lyric book called Diary of a Newlywed Poet is how it translates into the English from Spanish. And it's all these poems, basically they're like love poems to the sea. Because he went on a boat he leaves Cadiz in Spain and he go into New York, and in that whole journey on the boat he's just writing about how much he loves the sea. But actually, what's happening is he's about to marry the woman that he's wanted to marry. He's feeling love, and he's so infused with the love and, you know, the way in which he's anticipating this, entering this marriage, is that he channels all of that energy of love to the sea.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I mean, if he was stuck on the M25, you know, like that, but that is that, you know, that's that.
Be in love, stuck on the M25.
Oh, baby.
I've been there.
Oh, like, oh, baby.
Yeah, when I look at, like, when Hannah changes lanes, me as a, like, a very anxious driver, I'm like, my God.
Poems from a newlywed coming from Underwood.
Changing lanes. The third collection.
It would be so lovely to hear another poem from you both to close us out of the podcast this afternoon. Raymond, would you like to read?
Sweet. Yeah, so this is a new poem. It's called Fit and Moral. And I wrote like a series of poems while my wife is pregnant, about to become a dad. And I wrote, a lot in this quite... state of delirium, you know, all of that. All of that. So this poem, I think, also fits into some of the stuff we've been talking about, the internal space, external space. It's called Fit and Moral. The man vomiting in the park has only the tree to lean on. His green sick gushing out like water from a busted hydrant. The woman working out by the bench, mid-lunge, turns away. The man, grunting through pull-ups in the climbing frame, closes his eyes. The crack and spit of sickness is everywhere. Everyone is tangled in the mess. No one moves towards naming. Look at me preaching, writing. Noticing is a small and quiet way to begin moving away from the passive crowd. Oh God, look. My gym bag that reads lift, laugh, live? What form will I take now? Is some fit and mole saint about to appear?
Thank you so
That's
much.
A really good New Year's poem as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Victoria.
Okay, so I'll read a poem from the book called Dear Little Bee. Dear Little Bee, I love to see you sat there, pregnant with promise and nobody's business. Be bodacious if you feel like it. Be camouflaged if not. Some might say you should be louder, bolder, tall, uppercase and camera ready. But little bee, you're weary, aren't you, of being counted in the wrong kinds of ways. Besides, haven't you been capital forever? Haven't you been asterisked for far too long? No longer or not since or not enough, some might think, and let them think it. But as for me, little bee, I'll be blunt now. I like the way you lay low, the way you stay low and keep shooting.
Thank you so much, both. This has been such a beautiful conversation. And it's just been an honour to have you guys here and to chat through your books.
Thank you.
Appreciate
this. Yeah,
it's
great.
Been really fun. Thank you.
Hi. I'm recording this on the North End headland at Werri Beach in Gerringong, New South Wales, Australia. And you can probably hear the waves in the background. The swell's like maybe 1.5 metres. And the poem I'm about to read is called My Life as an Artist. I lost sleep last night. So tired, my head is a potato. My life was always art, but work made it dirt. Is life always dirt? I lost my night working potatoes. A tired head, but my last sleep was art. My part is in, a new bearing from which thick plants bud. Much depression arises from the underground. I'm chasing versions of me through alleyways in search of a thought, a furtive heart, a tuber in the dark. My, so much potato. But I made it art last night. Is life always tired? Night is lost sleep. My head work was dirt. My depression is a much thickened underground part bearing buds from which new plants arise. Lost my work last night. My life was dirt. My head is but a tired potato. Sleep is a lost art. Which plants bear the buds from the underground? My depression is thick. Growth is spoiled. And what of labour? I don't do work. I hold the hands. Help in my harvest. It's my soil. Me. I know what I'm onto. Please. A dark thought in a tuber. I am in an alleyway, chasing furtive versions of my heart. Search through me. Hold on. Don't harvest my labour. I help the growth of the soil, and I know it's working. I am the spoils. Please me. My hands know what to do. I'm chasing versions of me in dark alleyways, in search of a furtive thought, a tuber for a heart. I am working on my growth, its harvest, my hands in the soil. Please, help me. I hold the spoils of my labour, and I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do, and I don't know how to live with it. And that poem was written using a constraint. So each stanza was one set of words, and then to create a new stanza, I rearranged the exact same words just in a different order. And each set of words has three variations. And yeah, bye from Australia.
That was so cool, Jack. Mm. I love that so much. I love it when we're told where the poets are as well.
Yeah. Do you remember back when Natalie Shapiro was like, a truck nearly reversed into my building just now?
Yeah, yeah.
But like, yeah, Holly's standing there. Yeah, I should say that was that's Holly Eisenmunger. and the poem My Life as an Artist from her amazing debut collection, Greatest Hit, that's published by Vagabond Press in Australia. It's quite tricky to get hold of in the UK because of the postage situation. But, you know, this is what you want to do. You want to get the...
Yeah. But, I mean, that poem is so amazing. And I was interested in the constraint. Is this like a known constraint? Has she invented it?
No, I know that Holly likes kind of the strange tension between the lyric and constraint.
Yeah.
And the way in which kind of certain operations or predetermined operations inform and constraint sort of force the lyric to bend and do weird things.
Yeah, I sort of didn't know it was like a... I knew that there was some kind of like rhythmic play and some kind of repetition with...
Potatoes.
Like potato artwork, dirt.
Life.
Life.
Yeah.
And then the tubers coming. I quite like how it sort of like starts to replicate itself quite weirdly. Like you have these repetition of words and then there's like tuba and then there's like labor and then there's underground and there are these kind of growths that come out of the original constraint, which feels really subterranean.
Rhizomatic.
Yeah.
Like tuberous. I mean, I think like there's the nouns head, potato, like my head is a potato, tired head. I lost my art last night. Sleep is a lost art. The way that these different kind of, it's interesting that she's sort of like reading the poem at the beach near the surf
because
it's almost like something being turned over by the surf.
Yeah.
And of course, like my life as an artist is this kind of funny.
Well, it's like quite grandiose. It's like you would expect, or like, yeah, she's undoing that kind of like idea of it to be some kind of like grandiose.
Yeah.
I'm gonna paint for 3 hours a day and then have sex with my wife.
Yeah, it's more like depressed and anxious.
And machinic. It's very machinic. It's like, I do this thing, I become this thing, and then there's like a kink and I do this thing and da-da-da-da-da. Like, it feels very authentically about the repetition of work.
And
making art. Work and, like, the difference between work and art and labour, all things being labour.
There's some in that kind of turning over. I mean, like, often when you're working with constraint, the benefits of it is that it forces you to do things that you wouldn't ordinarily come up with yourself, you know, because it kind of forces a new logic. And there's just so many lovely, like, strange constructions that do come up. Growth is spoiled and what of labour... I don't do work. I hold the hands. Help me in my harvest. You know, that's gorgeous.
Yeah, it feels like a sort of, a poem that you would expect, but heard in a dream almost. Like the lines are really queered and the lines are really like altered by, like there's an expectation of them that's turned in on itself via the constraint. Like the form kind of turns the expectation around.
I like that it appears to also like just like sack off the constraint like there's that my depression is a much thickened underground part bearing buds from which new plants arise, like it's there's that part. And I also like my part is in. I don't know, like the different, like sometimes, and I love those strange, like my.
Yeah, I love that, yeah. And it also, but it starts to like degenerate, you know, like she gets to please help me.
Yeah.
At the end. And I got to that and I was like, oh yeah, that makes so much. I feel like everything has been written to come to this conclusion or this statement, this appeal.
Well, yeah, I'm trapped. I'm trapped in this
potato.
Strange potato neurotic need to make art against everything, against like the sort of absurdity of my labor and my laboring. I don't know what to do, and I don't know what to do.
I like the
and
title.
I don't know how to live with it.
Yeah, it's amazing. The title as well. I was like thinking it could even be something like My Potato as a Life, My Artist as Potato. You know, it has this kind, you know those things where you like move the head and the body and the legs?
Yeah.
And the shoes, like they're people and you kind of move their body parts around.
Yes, like a sort of maquette, what are they called? A mannequin?
Yeah. That's what it feels like you're moving these parts.
Mm.
Which is like working, you know.
It is like dragging your sorry sort of like meat shell and like little brain pudding back to the practice of like thinking and feeling and I'm writing again for the first time in ages, and I'd just forgotten. Actually, it was kind of blissful not writing because when you're just like the kind of, oh, that's no good. Oh, that's good. Oh, that's awful. And, you know, like, it is work. It's tiring.
You do have to write the shit to get to the...
Yeah, and you feel like sleep is a lost art and my head is a potato. Mm. And you are tired. Mm. And then you think, like, God, I can't, I don't, you know, I have to do this. I do this whether I want to or not. Mm. And I don't know how to live with it.
Mm. Cyclical.
Beautiful,
like the poem.
Yeah, it's a smashing poem, and I love. It's like not remotely gimmicky. That
not at all.
Like, because sometimes you get like a thing, and you're like, particularly if there's like this is a sequence of 14 poems, you know, taken from a Dictionary of Harvesting, written in 1842, and you're just like, yeah. This is like work that is using that beautiful marriage of form and subject. Using those repetitions to sort of churn and broil. Mm. Boil your head.
Cook your potatoes.
Exactly. And to put us on our horse and ride us beyond the horizon where the sunset breaks like an egg, we have an audio postcard from Dawn Watson.
This is an extract from We Ghost Tigers, which is the fourth and final poem sequence in We Play Here. Next time, Max was it. Sam bolted to the new estate, wired to the bottom of Ashfield. Nell grabbed my wrist and pulled me over the main road. We jumped the wall in front of the flats, right beside the bus stop for town and a black taxi idling. We crouched on the wet grass. I rocked back on my heels. I said, "Heard you got beat up round Seaview Drive." Nell blinked at me. From one eye, a purple cantaloupe. "Yes," she said, "I am bruised. Today, the wolf pack dandered up the Antrim Road to eat me. I've had my fill of housing estates. I am wild and ready to leave." She shifted foot to foot. Nell said, "I'm banjaxed." Her blue eyes shook. I said, "Oh, I'm banjaxed too." She whispered, "Let's run away to Woolworths and steal two whole trays of fizzy laces. Apple, cola, I don't care." A woman at the bus stop shouted over the road to a woman behind us. "Any more shite out of your man, Linda?" She said, "I make myself small, Jackie. You know yourself." Nell and Sam scuffed up to the black foot of the tree. "Have you checked for your dad in the Grove Park?" Nell asked. We knew why she asked. Men died there every summer and were found swinging by kids and people cutting through to the big furniture shop or for Mr. Whippy in the Shore Road petrol station. Someone's mum got beaten and stuffed in a bush once. Sam said, "Are you sure he's not asleep in the house? Or did he go on holiday?" Max pulled her top lip down as far as it went. "Could he be lost in town?" I asked. Nell hopped three steps, kicked a stone at the stream. Sam stared, squeezed her right arm with her left hand. Max pushed her lip between her teeth and bit down. "Let's check the park first," I said. We squeezed back under the fence, one by one. It was almost two. We jumped the concrete bollards down the overgrown lane. We took across Premier Drive and down the long entry behind Fort William Parade, overrun with clinging nettles, brambles and puddles. We ducked a taut washing line, stretched from a yard to a tree. One time, Nell's brother ran straight into it. He groaned like, "Huh!" and saw both feet at eye level as he thrillingly snapped to a halt.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Rachel Allen and Jack Underwood and produced by Hannah Marshall, Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen for Faber and Faber.
You can listen to our podcast on your favourite audio platform. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and tell your friends about our show.